Eric Idle of Monty Python fame once hosted a concert, at the start of which he announced, "The following presentation contains coarse language, sex, and nudity." He then proceeded to recommend that anyone in the audience under the age of 12 or of a sensitive disposition should... However, anyone taller than a keyhole, the insensitive and the potty mouth should really stick around and potty till you drop. Welcome to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. I'm Christine Bruce. Consider me your grandmotherly accomplice for the next half hour. Tungsten broadcasts at the saddest hour on Wet'suwet'en territory through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. Beware, this episode is R-rated, as in rollicking. In this episode, aka Potty Till You Drop, we're not discussing a book so much as a literary device. Swearing. We're going to explore some of the sensible, scientifically recognized reasons why people swear, and how building tungsten is a big part of it. Yep, you heard that right. This nana intends to hurl abuse at you, blaspheme, cuss, be entirely inappropriate and irreverent, swear like a sailor, curse up a blue streak, and exhibit some very, very bad language. And I promise it will all be radio safe. Let's go get into some profane mischief. Swear words attract attention because they've intentionally been developed around taboos that make us uncomfortable. I'm talking about taboos like private body parts. Oh, bare naked ladies. Bodily functions, sex, and raw anger. We've trained ourselves to be shocked when we hear strong language, and the person swearing may be considered antisocial and offensive, which often leads to social isolation and depression. There's the tungsten moment. Strong emotions like fear and anger and frustration make me want to use strong language. Politics, war, the environment, housing and jobs, all these things are stressing us out! In 2017, the magazine Business Insider commented, "What makes swear words offensive is that people are ready to be offended by them. It's almost as if society as a whole takes a conscious, or actually unconscious, decision to say this word is taboo, while other words are not offensive. It's completely arbitrary." In literature, the use of swear words is considered a rhetorical device to enhance the effectiveness and impact of the message, or the credibility of the speaker. So swear words are a useful device. And Mark Twain once commented, "Under certain circumstances, profanity provides a relief denied even to prayer." The site Babbel.com identifies four reasons to explain why people indulge in strong language in everyday conversation. The first reason is, it's cathartic, or you have an emotive reaction. When you're frustrated, surprised, or angry, swearing provides an emotional release. Researchers at Keele University in the United Kingdom have done experiments demonstrating that swearing increases the body's ability to endure pain. I can attest to this. Hourly, I battle allergies. I've inherited a body that's mildly allergic to the whole world, which means that if there are multiple allergens in a room, my discomfort levels increase. When I start swearing unexpectedly, it's often because I'm letting off steam so I can manage the discomfort until I can physically move away from the allergens. The second reason is insult, abuse, and exclusion. I could taunt someone with a simple, "You're ugly," or I could add a swear word or two to increase the rage concentrate as in, "You're bleeping ugly," and that'll show 'em. The third reason is group solidarity, because swearing provides a form of bonding with friends, especially when you all share a lexicon of specific words. And the last reason is for style and emphasis. Anyone who engages in colorful language will apply a well-placed F-bomb as alchemy, adding emotion and urgency to an otherwise neutral sentence. Did you know that swear words aren't considered words in our brains? Swear words are treated like concentrated lumps of emotion and are stored in a completely different part of the brain from language. Formal language is stored in the Broca's and Wernicke's areas in the brain. Swear words are stored in the limbic system, which are neural networks that control emotions and drives. So if you look at it that way, you can understand better why banning certain words in society has never worked. When I first learned to read, I spent a couple of weekends deciphering the hundreds of words that were graffitied on the local school walls. Only once did I come home and ask my parents about a certain four-letter word. They blanched and quickly changed the subject. My brain got the immediate message to store that sucker in a different part of my neural networks, apparently. I was born into a good Catholic family. Every Sunday we attended Mass, and in grade 9 I was dutifully enrolled with and walked daily with my best friend in all weathers, the 2.6 kilometers to our town's only Catholic high school. Oh, I can type up a storm, and my Latin and French are passable, but in those days, the nuns couldn't afford to offer a drama class or a band option. We didn't go on class trips or invite guests to our study halls. And I wanted more. So for grade 13, I transferred to the public high school just 3 blocks from my home, and there I met Chris Smith. Mr. Smith was my English teacher, a very respectable, good and decent man in his proper suit and tie. I thought him worldly wise and approachable and fun. When he introduced himself to us the first day, he made a joke of his own name. Chris Smith. Chris Smith. My high school friends always called me Mary because my name sounds like a holiday, doesn't it? Mary Chris Smith. He obviously had a good sense of humor, and I recall one day his commenting that his favorite forms of literature were the ones that included a good swearing session. In grade 13, that felt like he was giving us carte blanche to let it all out. And in those days, KCBI happened to be the most elite high school in town. Mr. Smith was encouraging us to see the meaning behind the words in the classics we were reading together, in modern poetry, and in plays. For instance, in The Tempest, William Shakespeare offers the line, "You taught me language, and my prophet aunt is, I know how to curse." It's curious, because Shakespeare merely alluded to, but didn't employ profanities in his work. Unless you know what you're reading, Shakespeare comes across as prudish compared to others in his time, like Ben Jonson, who included frequent interjections like "a turd in your teeth" and "I fart at thee." Shakespeare still manages to be quite crude with euphemisms, what is described as a more creative vein of obscenity. In Shakespeare's day, the word nothing also meant no thing, thing meaning penis, which is a euphemism for the female genitalia. So when Hamlet tells Ophelia that nothing is a fair thought between a maid's legs, he's referencing her naughty bits, which brings a whole new meaning to the title Much Ado About Nothing. When I worked in the Toronto software industry, I interacted with a lot of people from other countries. Turns out Canadians are awfully polite in their speech. My Canadian co-workers would often ask me to tone it down, and yet my British friends could swear up a storm that made me blush. One of them pointed out that describing strong language speakers as having potty mouth was a phrase dismissed as childish in the UK, and that we needed to grow a spine on this side of the Atlantic. And then there's the universal love of collecting swear words in another language. It's like little boys giggling over phrases like bare naked ladies. When I had kids, I turned to this option happily. My 4-year-old son would suggest we watch Star Wars of an afternoon, blurting out the Huttie's phrase coined by Jabba the Hutt, "Ah, shoota, digital blinky." That comment would come in handy later, when we wiped away tears from an especially nasty encounter with a bee's nest, and the afternoon he was frustrated at the neighborhood kids dismissing him as a crap friend. "Ah, shoota," I would comment. Somehow it didn't matter so much anymore. In 1972, comedian George Carlin released his 4th album entitled Class Clown. The track, 7 words You Can Never Say on Television, was a monologue on the ridiculous power that we give to certain words. Carlin was arrested for disturbing the peace that year when he performed the routine at Summerfest in Milwaukee. Here's a clip from that 2004 NPR interview.
George Carlin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Terry.
Can you talk about what led to this routine? Like what you were thinking about, how you wrote it?
Well, I don't really know that there was a eureka moment or anything like that. What happened was I'd always held these attitudes. I've always been sort of anti-authoritarian, and I really don't like arbitrary rules and regulations that are essentially designed to get people in the habit of conforming and obeying authority blindly. So I have always resisted that in my life as a child, as an adolescent, and as a young adult. And so I held that attitude. That's the fertile ground for all of this. Secondly, I have a strong interest in language that is in part genetic and part then fostered by my mother. I have always taken great joy in looking closer, more closely at language. So those things were in place. On these other things, we get into the field of hypocrisy, where that you really cannot pin down what these rules they want to enforce are. It's just impossible to say this is a blanket rule. You'll see some newspapers print F blank blank K. Some print F asterisk asterisk K. Some blank F. Some put F blank blank blank. Some put the word bleep. Some put expletive deleted. So there's no real consistent standard. It's not a science. It's a notion that they have, and it's superstitious. These words have no power. We give them this power by refusing to be free and easy with them. We give them great power over us. They really in themselves have no power. It's the rest of the sentence that makes them either good or bad.
In your 1972 recording, you talk about how it's perfectly okay to say, "Don't prick your finger," but mm-hmm. you can't say "don't finger your blank."
Yeah, you can't reverse the two
words. You can't reverse the two words. So comics work with the power of words. And mm-hmm. in a way, the fact that certain words are supposed to be taboo, as you point out, that yes. gives them power.
That's right.
And that makes yeah. those words more powerful for you when you want to mm-hmm. use them. So do you feel like you've been able to work with the taboo nature of certain words and, you know, make that work in your favor?
Well, what...
Like in that classic routine.
Yeah. That is an interestingly disguised way, and I don't mean you were trying to deceive me or anything, but it's in a disguised way of saying, well, don't some people just use these for shock value? You get this phrase all the time from interviewers, shock value. Well, shock is a kind of a heightened form of surprise, and surprise is at the heart of comedy. So if you're using the word in a way to heighten the impact of the sentence or season the stew, they are, after all, great... seasonings. There are sentences that, without the use of hell or damn, even lose all their impact. So they have a proper place in language, and in my case, I just like them because they are real and they do have impact. They do make a difference in a sentence. But if you're using them for their own sake, that's probably kind of weak. If you're using them in some way that you feel enhances what you're doing and delivering, that's another thing.
Did you ever expect that comedy routine would be actually played on the radio and it would be part of a case that made it all the way to the Supreme Court and that it would become as important and famous a case as it became?
Well, I knew that it wasn't out of the question that it maybe played on the radio. FM radio stations at that time, and there were commercial ones who qualified as what was called underground radio, and an awful lot of liberties were taken with music, too. Music that had very... God, I hate the words explicit and graphic, but those are the words that would be used by someone to describe those kind of songs, those lyrics. I knew there was a chance, but of course, no one ever sees other things coming that are unexpected and larger, you know. I just knew that I had done a piece that summed up my position very well and sort of had a nice, it had a wonderfully rhythmic, the reading of those seven words, the way they were placed together, had a magnificent kind of a jazz feeling, a rhythm that was just very natural and satisfying, the way those syllables were placed together. And so I knew I had done something was making an important point about the hypocrisy of all of this.
Every swear word out there has a unique appeal, and some are outright unacceptable, depending on who and where you are. But some are educational, some relieve a need in us, and some are purely entertaining. Some swear words might make you nostalgic. I don't suggest you try every swear word I throw out in this episode, because everyone's different, thank Godzilla. But here are a few that you'll almost certainly recognize for your articulating pleasure. Let's begin with a few that a child can swing around. As an ankle biter, some of my best language learning came from the Saturday morning cartoons. Yosemite Sam was my muse. Some of the best nonsense swear words that ever graced the television were, and I quote, "Dad, burn it." This is one of the few remnants of Dad as a euphemism for God. "What in tarnation?" Another euphemism, this time for damnation. And finally, the close to not acceptable on the radio, "Rackin' frackin'," or "Rassafrassin'." These are Sam at his naughtiest, with his obvious solution to the F-word. Rassafrassin is the lexical equivalent of Grolix, which is a comic strip gimmick consisting of symbol stand-ins for swearing, like percentage sign, asterisk, exclamation mark, ampersand, dollar sign. Well, I mean, really? If you've ever read The Adventures of Tintin, you've probably run into Captain Haddock. The captain's vocabulary is limited, but very colorful. Someone gathered all his curses, insults, and exclamations into a group online and discovered that he'd been profane an astonishing 219 times in the series. "Addle-pated lumps of anthracite, billions of bilious blue blistering barnacles, thundering typhoons," and am not averse to a particularly impassioned "blistering barnacles" when the need arises. John Buchan, as we learned a couple of weeks ago, was a Scottish novelist, historian, and politician who served as Governor General of Canada from 1935 until his death in 1940. He's now best known as a writer notable for his espionage thrillers. The 39 Steps is the first in a series where Buchan's First World War protagonist, Richard Hannay, employs strong language to demonstrate his growing fears over politics and intelligence secrets. For example, in the sequel Green Mantle, I discovered this line. I could hear him invoking some unknown deity called Holy Mike. And then there's the epitome of profane, Monty Python. Consider the Pet Shop skit, in which Cleese is trying to convince Palin that the parrot is dead, eventually ending with, "He's f***ing snuffed it." Or the Cheese Shop sketch, where Cleese dismisses the texture of the brie with the comment, "I don't care how f***ing runny it is, hand it over with all speed." We've just quoted Yosemite Sam, Captain Haddock, one of our Canadian governors general, and John Cleese. All people of some renown that I'm pretty certain everyone would accept as part of civilized society. I'm not potty mouthed. I'm enlightened. You are listening to CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. You may need a break from the stream of invectives, so I'll clean up my act for a quick public service announcement. Classic Sanitary Supplies on Broadway Avenue offers cleaning equipment for Smithers automotive shops, healthcare facilities, shelters, clinics, and janitorial companies. They sell products from a variety of trusted brands and are proud to offer Eco Logo and Green Seal certified brands. And we at the station happen to quite like the owner, Derek Graham. You know what else they've got? They've got the world's best graffiti removal system. From when a Captain Haddock lookalike writes billions of bilious blue blistering barnacles on your business wall. Or Yosemite Sam stand-in proclaims his dislike of some rackin' frackin' politician. Or when an erudite Shakespearean scholar spray paints "I fart at thee" on one of our passing train cars. Oops. I guess my act wasn't so cleaned up. Holy Mike. Major Gregory Clark was a Canadian war veteran, journalist, and humorist. Clark was best known for his work as a reporter for the Toronto Star from 1911 to 1946, where he covered various news events, but particularly for his frontline World War II coverage. In the 1930s, he started a popular humor column, which was widely syndicated throughout Canada into the early 1970s. In 1967, he was made one of the initial officers of the Order of Canada for the humor which he brought to his profession as a newspaper writer and radio commentary. This is his wonderful short story, The Reverence, in its entirety. It seems to me the previous generation was more humorous, wittier, quicker on the trigger than this. all the carefully scripted and rehearsed wit and humor of radio, TV, and the movies may have taken the wind out of the sails of us ordinary jokers. We would rather not compete, perhaps. There was a golf tournament between Lambton Golf Club in Toronto and the Galt Ontario Club. My father, the late Joseph T. Clark, a representative member of his generation, was one of the Lambton team and was in his underwear in the locker when he heard a large, loud, profane voice at the far end of the room demand, "Who the hell is W.E. Grigg?" My old man stepped out to see who had spoken. It was a big, bearded man, a stranger, obviously one of the visiting Galt team. It happened that W.E. Grigg was my uncle, my dapper uncle, Ontario manager for Massey Harris, and known for his gift of profanity on the golf course. He was one of those men who can't play golf unless he cusses. Quick as a bat out of the belfry, my father went up to the bearded stranger, a profane man, obviously, and said, quietly and reprovingly, "Excuse me, but W.E. Grigg is the Reverend Mr. Grigg, the well-known Presbyterian divine." The stranger looked down at my father in shocked silence for a moment and then said, "Thanks for the tip. My name is McKendrick, Dr. McKendrick." "I thought I'd just mention," murmured my father. "Much obliged," said the doctor gratefully. And as my old man hurriedly dressed, he could hear the Galt doctor luridly protesting to his friends a system of drawing that would match him against a parson. His game was ruined before he started. My father knew where to find Uncle Bill. He would be out practicing up his putting on the practice green. There was Dapper Bill, muttering to himself. "Who are you drawn against?" inquired my old man cheerily. "Dr. McKendrick," said Bill. "Oh," cried my old man, "that'll be the Reverend Dr. McKendrick from Galt, the well-known Presbyterian divine." Uncle Bill straightened slowly up with an expression of horror on his face. "The Reverend?" he gasped. "Who the blankety-blank-bluey would draw me against a parson? What kind of a committee have we got that would pair me with a minister of all the biffity-boom-bang?" And in a jumping fury, Uncle Bill flung his putter down. "Shh," said my father, for the Reverend McKendrick was just emerging from the locker room door. He waved and came over. Uncle Bill hastily picked up his putter and tried to calm himself. "Dr. McKendrick," said my old man. "Mr. Grigg." The two victims shook hands warmly, with that special, respectful manner we reserve for the meeting of the clergy. They walked over to the first tee, chatting pleasantly of this and that, as one does under the circumstances. Uncle Bill teed off first, hitting one of his high, twisting loopers. "Dear, dear, dear," he said, very flushed. Dr. McKendrick drove off, topping it down the fairway about 60 yards. He muttered in his beard, "Dear me." And away they went. Most earnestly and piously, they played 11 holes, the worst game either of them had played in years, until Uncle Bill got into a bunker and, after half a dozen horrible swipes, suddenly let loose. Dr. McKendrick stood by, amazed, moved, delighted, and shocked to hear a parson using language he himself would envy. Uncle Bill apologized. I beg your pardon, Dr. McKendrick," he said contritely, "but I just couldn't hold it in any longer, even if you are a minister." "Me a minister?" cried McKendrick. "Aren't you a minister?" asked Uncle Bill. "I was told you were a minister," shouted McKendrick. The situation was quickly cleared up, and the two proceeded with a much better game, both of them addressing the ball, their clubs, the earth, the sky, and all else in their normal and fluent fashion, and had a grand time for the remaining 7 holes. At the 19th, they caught up with my old man. You can't do an episode on swearing without a nod to the F word. Some claim that the F word derives from "for unlawful carnal knowledge," but this theory's been debunked by etymologists. The word became regarded as vulgar in the 18th century and was even banned from the Oxford English Dictionary. But it's just a word. I don't want to get into trouble with my station manager,
So in this element, I'll be employing two excellent alternatives that will help me release steam, demonstrate enthusiasm, and generally color up my speech satisfactorily. A friend once recommended inserting a name wherever an off-color word appeared. Someone recently congratulated me on having the good luck to be able to employ my own name this way. Christine Almighty, I can happily mutter. I personally have a lifelong love affair with the F word. It's very versatile. It can be used in almost every informal situation and to express any emotion. It's a magical word. Just by its sound, it can describe pain, pleasure, hate, and love. What really matters is the tone of voice you use and what words surround it. And yet, it is a strong word and we continue to dislike it. So, I'm going to replace the word with the name Frank, so you can get a little language lesson in. The radio safe version. In language, Frank falls into many grammatical categories. It can be used as a verb, both transitive, as in to frank, and intransitive, to be franked by, and as a noun, a frank. It can be used as an adjective, as in the very popular and exhaustingly overused descriptor, franking. Apart from the sexual meaning, there are many, many other uses. To express ignorance, franked if I know. To express trouble, I guess I'm franked now. Fraud, I got franked at the used car lot. Aggression, frank you. Displeasure, what the frank is going on here? Difficulty, I can't understand this franking rule. Incompetence, he's a frank up. Suspicion, what the frank are you doing? Enjoyment, I had a frank and good time. Request, get the frank out of here. Hostility, I'm gonna knock your frankin' head off. Greeting, how the frank are ya? Apathy, who gives a frank? Innovation, get a bigger frankin' hammer. Surprise, frank, you scared the hell out of me. Anxiety, today is really franked. And my personal favorite, frustration, what the frankety frank? You can also use frank in the middle of words to add emphasis to them. Expletive infixation is a process by which an expletive or profanity is inserted into a word, usually for intensification, as in abso-frankin-lutely. It can be used as a pronoun, like frank face. As a conjunction, I went swimming frank the cold, as in despite the cold. As an interjection, frank, I sure wish I could find a date tonight. Even as an auxiliary verb to describe a progressive activity. He's frank and sleeping, dude. And finally, there's epistemic modality. The occasionally necessary how dare you can be expressed in a single word, frank. See, very versatile. Mr. Smith approved. But just in case inserting frank didn't carry the same level of power you needed to express yourself properly, here are all those uses again with a set of radio bleeps. The transitive, John is f***ing Jenny. The intransitive, Jenny is being f***ed by John. A noun, Jenny is a fine f***. An adjective, as in the very popular and exhaustingly overused descriptor, f***ing. Ignorance, f***ed if I know. Trouble, I guess I'm f***ed now. Fraud, I got f***ed at the used car lot. Aggression, f*** you. Displeasure, what the f*** is going on here? Difficulty, I can't understand this rule. Incompetence, he's a f*** up. Suspicion, what the f*** are you doing? Enjoyment, I had a f***ing good time. Request, get the f*** out of here. Hostility, I'm gonna knock your f***ing head off. Greeting, how the f*** are ya? Apathy, who gives a f***? Innovation, get a bigger f***ing hammer. Surprise, you scared the hell out of me. Anxiety, today is really f***ed. And my personal favorite, frustration. What the f***ity f***? Expletive in fixation. Abso-f***ing-lutely. A pronoun. Face. A conjunction. I went swimming. The cold. An interjection. I was sure I could find a date tonight. An auxiliary verb to describe a progressive activity. He's f***ing sleeping, dude. Epistemic modality, which replaces the medieval how dare you with a single word. And finally, I'd like to share my favorite use of this word in modern art. It's cathartic, It's rhetorical, it's entertaining, and it makes me want to jump up and be a good human being. Sarah Millican, the British stand-up comedian and writer, recently offered some advice she'd been given when she was feeling low. The advice was this: don't look for the light at the end of the tunnel. Stomp down there and turn the f***er on yourself.
Lagan Price, Hagen Pear, Highlander, coming in so spread, coming in so spread, coming in so spread, coming in so spread. Sei pünktlich, sei pünktlich, sei pünktlich, coming in so spread, coming in so spread, coming in so spread, coming in so spread.
My 5-year-old crush advises inserting the word poop into random sentences. It lightens the heart immeasurably. And as we discussed earlier, the word can be transformed into various parts of speech. I'm pooped. Oh, poop. That's poopy. You can use it in song lyrics. Oh, there's endless possibilities. And they'll all make someone giggle. Now, like everything, there's a time and place for strong language. The fact that I'm offering you radio-safe options is a good example. And lots of times, you need to consider your audience. Not everyone is going to welcome a stream of invective like my Mr. Smith did. In fact, I have several friends from that Catholic high school upbringing who, if they've tuned in, are probably unfriending me and taking me off their Christmas card list right now. So, time and place are important. The other point I want to stress is that swearing isn't a good policy if you're targeting someone with it. Calling someone something derogatory, or worse, gossiping about them behind their back, are never going to end well. We don't need a scientific study to prove that. And that's isolating. You've been listening to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. Tungsten is produced by Christine Bruce. Air through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. Available anytime at smithersradio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. Let's get into mischief again soon. In case you need a fix this week, I'm going to leave you with a stream of invective. A daisy chain of expletives. The worst of the worst that's all radio safe. Heavens to Murgatroyd! Oh, poop. Zybookish! Ding, bust it! Dag nabbit! Confound it! Holy mackerel! Crikey! Ah, shoo, the digital blinky! What the frankity frank! Holy Mike! Percentage, asterisk, exclamation, ampersand, dollar sign!